Philip Lee, welcome to the Bookshelf Conversations.
Thank you, Ron. Pleasure to be
So,
here.
congratulations on your new book, Black Stats Matter: Integrating Negro League Numbers into Major League Records. Now, I was under the impression that this was a done deal, that Major League Baseball had agreed to roll those numbers into its archives.
Well, originally, the book was written as an argument to do exactly that, to combine the statistics, because I started the research for it before that decision was taken. And I very nearly abandoned the project until I saw the reactions to statistical integration that were popping up on ESPN and other related sports sites, discussion sites like the Baseball Hall of Merit. The opinion that was most often expressed by people of genuine goodwill was that Negro Leaguers shouldn't really be considered on a par with Major Leaguers because they performed at 80% or 90% or even 70% of the same level. And that struck me as being, well, absurd, to be honest with you. If you consider the performance of the initial wave of Negro Leaguers who were admitted into the major leagues, to say that their counterparts who were not admitted were not of major league class just struck me as an absurdity. So I carried on with the research, was shocked to find how prevalent that view of Negro League's inferiority still was, and how common the counterarguments were, and put together as good an argument as I can, or I could, that equivalency was necessary, true equivalency, 100% to 100% across the board. And further, that acknowledging true equivalency had Negro Leaguers capturing some very important major league records. It's one thing to say that major league records and Negro League records are commensurate and should be regarded equally. And a lot of people said that, and a lot of people said the opposite. But as far as I could tell, with the sole exception of Todd Peterson, who did his compilation, The Negro Leagues or Major Leagues, no one had really tackled the proposition scientifically or historiographically. They hadn't crunched the numbers. They hadn't attempted to prove or disprove the idea of true equivalency. And Todd Peterson's effort, which I consider very admirable and very groundbreaking, and I have no doubt helped nudge the major leagues toward recognition of the Negro Leagues, is a succession of chapters by different authors examining one point at a time. There isn't really a coherent argument in it. So I decided to try to construct a coherent argument, a proof, as it were, that Negro League performance was equivalent to Major League performance, and that Negro League records should be taken on a par with Major League records.
I was always under the assumption, apparently, well, I don't want to say apparently mistaken, that the problem with the numbers was the calculation at the time, that the Negro League statistics, that there weren't the same attention to detail in the black media of the day, who overwhelmingly reported on the Negro Leagues as opposed to the, I don't know how to properly phrase it,
understand, alias and bureaus like that. Yeah.
Yeah. That just those numbers weren't there for them to compile. So is that a mistake?
No. Originally, if you look at the Hall of Fame plaques of the first Negro Leaguers admitted to the major leagues, the numbers that they contain are strictly anecdotal. You know, Josh Gibson is credited with nearly 800 home runs. Mm-hmm. To this day, it's not possible to credit Josh Gibson with nearly 800 home runs. The statisticians were going from word of mouth. They were going from legend. They were going from apocrypha. However, it's important to remember that our current understanding of the major leagues and its statistical base is largely built on work by pioneering researchers like Pete Palmer and Bill James, who in a lot of cases were hand compiling numbers that weren't being tracked by Major League Baseball itself. That's a statistical revolution that really started in the 1970s. And under the auspices of Gary Ashwill and Kevin Johnson, Seamheads, an extremely important resource that baseball reference now recognizes as a legitimate source for Negro League numbers, started the same process, but much later, with Negro Leagues baseball. And so particularly once you get into the era of organized leagues, once Rube Foster organizes the first Negro National League in 1920, you start to see much heavier reportage of Negro League numbers in newspapers. You start to see them reported in more newspapers. You start seeing them carried by national wire services that were willing to deal with material on Black teams and Black play. And when you get to 1944, there's another considerable step, because the official statistician for the American League, House Sports Bureau, started to keep track of Negro League numbers, and in fact, continued to do so until at least 1958, long past the point where we consider the Negro Leagues to be a major league quality organization. So the numbers, I guess that's the first part of my answer. The numbers are there now. They're probably not 100% complete, but they're not 100% complete for white baseball, I guess is the best way to put it, in any case. You may remember when Barry Bonds was making a run on Ted Williams's record, single season record for on-base percentage, the researchers went back to the box scores and they changed Ted Williams's on-base percentage record in the light of Barry Bonds's assault on it, because the research had just missed some stuff. The original research that took place in the 1970s and 80s had missed some box scores. Now, that's more true in the case of the Negro Leagues, because the Black press didn't have the economic power or the distribution reach that the white press did. The Negro Leagues specifically, in addition to other signs that they didn't command the capital of major league teams, like, for example, smaller rosters, 14 to 16 players instead of 25, they also couldn't afford to carry their own team statisticians. The people who did that for those teams more or less volunteered to do so. And so, yes, the numbers are more fragmentary. However, go back to the National Association from 1871 to 75. Go back to the National League from 1876 through 1900. Go back to the American Association. Go back to any of these old leagues that are commonly recognized as major leagues today. And you'll find the numbers are exceptionally fragmentary. Stolen bases and caught stealing are absent. Hit by pitch is absent. Intentional walks are absent. Sacrifice flies are absent. You can go on and on. The totals that literally do not exist in any form. In those instances, Negro League statistics are actually, in many cases, more complete than Major League statistics.
You mentioned Josh Gibson's home runs. The legend has him somewhere around 800.
Yes.
You do compile, and you have a wonderful register of several.
I'm glad you like that.
Of Negro League players, and while it is true, you credit Gibson with 234 home runs, I believe.
Yes,
and you do have him as leading his league more often than Babe Ruth did, but
yes,
with substantially lower numbers. So
yes,
that kind of reminds me of prior to Babe Ruth, the men who were leading the league in home runs were getting 8 home runs, 12 home runs, 20
yes,
home runs. So that's where I wonder somewhat about the equivalency. I'm not a numbers person. I can't balance my checkbook, but comparing Ruth and Gibson without the actual final numbers, I think I just wonder about that.
Let me address that briefly. If you look at major league slugging percentages and isolated power numbers prior to the advent of the live ball era, which also coincides with the beginning of the Negro Leagues, you're going to see much lower slugging. You're going to see much lower isolated power because the ball tended to stay on the ground. You didn't have the introduction of clean baseballs yet. You didn't have the banning of the spitball yet. And you also didn't have the exemplar of Ruth, who was the first person to consistently attempt to undercut the ball and was willing to endure high strikeout numbers, which were very much frowned upon by early baseball aficionados, in order to get that uppercut, in order to launch the ball into the bleachers. Josh Gibson did compile smaller numbers, but if you look at home runs per game, which is a more context-neutral measure, he's much more in Ruth's level, because Negro Leagues teams played many fewer games than major league teams. Part of that is due to economic stability. It was not uncommon, for example, for a team to have a scheduled league game in the Negro Leagues and to abandon that game because another exhibition game elsewhere offered them more money. In any case, they didn't have the infrastructure to be able to maintain a 100-game season or 150-game season the way the major leagues did. So within the context of those smaller sample sizes and smaller numbers of games, Gibson's totals are, in fact, Ruthian. If you extrapolate those seasons out to 550 plate appearances, 600 plate appearances, more in the Ruthian range, you're going to see a lot of 50 and 60 home run seasons, the types of seasons that Ruth was putting up.
Now, I'm just quickly looking through, going back here. You have a chapter on arguments against statistical integration.
Yes.
And one of those arguments, if I can find it quickly, I'll paraphrase, and you'll correct me if I'm wrong. Sorry for the delay here. But basically, if I remember, it has something to do with smaller sample sizes, based on what you're saying about the fewer games played.
Yes.
The smaller sample size and extrapolating is that, you know, because you say a player can be hot for a short period of time.
Be lucky.
Or to be lucky. But to extend that over an entire 150-game season, whatever, is a little more challenging to me.
Yes, and that's why I advocate against combining single-season records, because the two data sets aren't commensurate with each other. Once you get the concept of standard deviation is that the more you do something, the lower the deviation. And the example that I give in the book is flipping a coin. I could sit here and flip a coin once, and if it came up heads, I could make the claim, well, there's a 1,000% or 100% chance that the next flip will come up heads. That's not true because the sample size is too small. If I flip it 10 times and it comes up heads 6 times, I still can't say the coin is 60% likely to come up heads next time, because 10 samples is still much too small a sample size. So when you're dealing with seasons of 200 plate appearances, or in some cases 100 plate appearances, it's not appropriate to compare those directly with seasons of 5 and 6 and even 700 plate appearances, in my personal view. However, once you get into the range of careers, then you're talking about thousands and thousands of plate appearances. Then standard deviation becomes much less important. If I were a batter with true 300 ability, and I had compiled enough plate appearances to have a standard deviation of 0.01, that would mean I could be 10 points above or 10 points below in terms of true ability. And, I could bat as high as 310 or as low as 290. Well, if you compare Josh Gibson with Ty Cobb, as I do when making the argument that Gibson should be recognized as the leader in batting average, Gibson has many fewer plate appearances than Ty Cobb in the range of 3,000 versus the range of 13,000. But Gibson's standard deviation is still only 0.09 and Cobb's is only 0.05. There's not that much room between them. And the range between Gibson's batting average and Cobb's batting average is so close that Gibson's potential can be above or below Cobb's. Cobb's potential can be above or below Gibson's. In other words, they were essentially equal as contact hitters, according to the rules of standard deviation. And it was mostly a matter of luck whether or not Gibson or Cobb came out on top as the leader in batting average. But it happens to be Gibson, in, by my evaluation.
I want to go back to something you said about the use of clean baseballs and the economic reality of the Negro Leagues. What was the equipment like comparing Major League Baseball with the Negro Leagues? Were the Negro Leagues able to supply fresh baseballs on a similar level? Do they have the quality of bats that the Major Leagues had at a similar level?
Bats, yes. They're using the same suppliers. Gloves, yes. They're using the same suppliers. Baseballs, the numbers were more limited, which is one of the reasons I say in the book that it's more appropriate to compare Negro League individual seasons to the 1890s or the 20s and 30s or the 1990s. The 1890s, in this case, being a germane comparison, because the baseballs were routinely almost invisible once dusk started to fall. And that's also a reason for dead ball era conditions, is that the baseball was harder to see. And that'll undoubtedly be a suppressor of Negro League's totals. Having said that, there was sufficient finance to provide a major league level of equipment, with the exception of stadiums. In the case of stadiums, Negro League teams had to rent major league stadiums, which they did very, very consistently. And there were a lot of fans of Negro League baseball. When a Negro League team appeared in Yankee Stadium, which happened all the time, they would draw 40,000 fans. They would draw 50,000 fans in some parks. In 1942, 43, and 44, the Negro League's All-Star Game outdrew the Major League All-Star Game by more than 10,000 attendees for each of those three games. So there was plenty of ticket money floating out there. The Negro Leaguers, however, had to then pay part of that revenue back to the stadiums, which was when baseball issued their secret McPhail report in 1946, which was very condemnatory of the prospects of Black players participating in Major League Baseball. One of the rationales recorded by Larry McPhail, and it was McPhail, because you can trace this stuff back to his statement to Fiorello LaGuardia's Commission on Unity in New York City. He recycled a lot of that language from his submission to them. One of his arguments for maintenance of separate leagues was that the major leagues were pocketing hundreds of thousands of dollars annually from renting of their stadiums. And so that's another way in which Negro Leagues baseball was straightened economically. But as Monty Irvin said, the bats were the same, the balls were the same, the diamonds were the same, the stadiums were the same. Why didn't they think our numbers counted?
You have a chapter on Bill James's 23 tests. Could you briefly explain what those are?
Yeah. Bill James is the godfather. To me, he's the greatest baseball writer ever. I know that there's a certain amount of picking on this or picking on that in terms of comments that he may have made in context outside baseball. But to me, he's the best baseball writer of all time. And the New Historical Baseball Abstract is the best baseball book of all time. And I unashamedly cite Bill James, I'm sure, more than any other author in this book. And more than that, his methodology informs me, which is to, and apologies, Mr. James, if you see this and I'm misrepresenting you, but I believe his methodology is to look at a problem and pick it apart into its components and tackle the components one by one. And in the New Historical Baseball Abstract, at different places, James mentions various ways in which the professional quality or the major league quality of a league can be judged. At one point in the abstract, he mentions a series of statistical tests. At another point in the abstract, he mentions a series of organizational tests. And at a further point in the abstract, I don't know if he intended this to be lumped into the same idea, he says that one strike against major league quality of a given league is the common success of teenaged pitchers. And I agree with that completely. You've got one teenage 20 game winner in the major leagues in the 20th century. You've got, I believe, 10 before the turn of the century, which is a much shorter period of time because the numbers only started being compiled in 1876. So I think clearly he's right. So I took the 23 tests from James's book that I felt applied to Negro Leagues baseball, and I took them apart mathematically and logically as best I could. And I tried to apply more than one test or more than one potential resolution to each of his tests. I tried to use context neutral measures wherever possible. And the conclusion that I drew was that out of those 23 tests, only one was unambiguously against the major leagues and the Negro Leagues as major leagues in James's estimation, and that was player height. And when you get into player height, you've got, I guess it's my opinion, and I wouldn't have put this in the book, and I disclaim this in the book, it's probably a nutrition issue. But because of the heavy prevalence of poor farm boys in the majors in the 20s, you can't say that with a certainty. So I had to say that is a case against the Negro Leagues as a major league. But if you look at this, particularly the statistical test, the percentage of double plays turned, the standard deviation of offensive effectiveness, the numbers of games which are blowouts and so forth, the Negro Leagues fall very neatly into major league play, particularly in the era just before the Negro Leagues, 1890s and 1900s, and also to an extent in the 1990s. The point is that all of they didn't necessarily fall into the same range during their own time. In other words, 1920s Negro Leagues baseball wasn't necessarily analogous to 1920s Major League Baseball. But Negro Leagues batting average on base and slugging was higher than dead ball baseball, but lower than live ball baseball, which means it was its own brand of baseball. Plus, they were playing a much more open game, many more sacrifice hits, many more stolen bases and attempted steals, much more daring base path running. And essentially, they were playing a different brand of baseball. In the same way that we would look at the Players League or the Union Association or the American Association or the Federal League or even the nascent American League in 1900 and 1901 and say they were playing a different brand of baseball from the National League. They were playing in different facilities. They were playing with different strategies. They were playing with a different player base. And the results that I came up with through pure mathematics, and I admit my bias. I wanted to find the way I found, but I didn't want the argument to lead the results, which is a logical fallacy. The result I found consistently was that Negro Leagues baseball fell well, comfortably, within the mathematical parameters of Major League Baseball.
Now, you do have baseballreference.com now includes the Negro Leagues. I looked up Willie Mays right before we spoke, and I see that his 1 year with the Birmingham Black Barons is included, whereas it might not have been before. But that's just on the register. They haven't recalculated the record book per se, like you say, Ty Cobb versus Josh Gibson as far as batting average goes. What would be the implications in doing that?
Well, there's a very basic stumbling block there, which is that you can't count part-time players against the all-time records, because otherwise you're going to get somebody who played one game in their career, went 2 for 3, hit 667, and you're going to say, well, that guy's the leader in batting average at 667. Yeah. It can't be done. So Baseball Reference adopted standards. This is before recognition of the Negro Leagues was part of the conversation. And they established minimums of 3,000 plate appearances for batters and 1,000 innings pitched for pitchers, which is great insofar as it applies to the major leagues. When you're looking at the Negro Leagues, Josh Gibson was a regular for 17 years. He played for 9 consecutive pennant winners, if you include his Mexican League experience in 1940 and 41. And yet he didn't accumulate 3,000 plate appearances. He was a regular catcher in the Negro Leagues in every possible sense of the word, and he was a very durable one. And yet he doesn't meet that 3,000 plate appearance minimum. And one of the things that I advocate in the book, and I looked at these numbers as close as I can and as closely as I could, and I'm not guaranteeing that other statisticians or historians will necessarily agree with my exact conclusions, but if I get the numbers right, 29 Negro Leaguers qualified under the 3,000 plate appearance rule. If you lower that to 2,000, 85 Negro Leaguers qualify, and they're all full-timers, and Josh Gibson is one of them. And I considered lowering that to 1,500, which produces over 120 qualifiers. The problem with that is the Negro Leagues is a fairly limited data set by definition, the professional play from 1920 to 48. And when you lower the plate appearance requirement to 1,500, you start seeing people appearing in the top 20 in calculated stats that don't appear anywhere in the top 20 in counting stats. And that struck me as illogical in the context of that limited a data set. So I set it at 2,000.
But excuse me, if you do that, then don't you have to include all the major league players who have fewer than 3,000 or more than 2,000? And wouldn't that finagle with the figures? Because you're having a lot more players who just missed those marks.
I can see the argument. Right now you're looking at, to use batters, 85 eligible Negro Leaguers versus over 1,100 eligible Major Leaguers to make the all-time roles. Anybody who can compile those kind of numbers by definition has longevity and by definition is a regular in one sense or another. And I can see a basis for the argument you're making, but I don't agree with it. And here's why. The only reason that Negro Leaguers didn't reach those statistical plateaus, in this case, 3,000 plate appearances, is that they were excluded from playing in the only organized North American league that had the financial stability to allow them to reach those statistical plateaus. Now, if you throw in their barnstorming and all of that, you're gonna see guys with 1,000 plate appearances in a season, but you can't do that. That's not professional quality baseball. So My argument is that there has to be a baseline adjustment for the systemic racism that kept these people from reaching those minimum benchmarks. And I have precedent, because in 1969, when talk first started about the Major League Hall, the Baseball Hall of Fame admitting Negro Leaguers, you had people like Bowie Kuhn running around saying, well, they're not really going to be Hall of Famers because they didn't play 10 seasons in the major leagues, which was the Hall of Fame's minimum baseline requirement. The Hall of Fame chose to disregard that for the simple reason that it was unjust. And I look at that 3,000 plate appearance baseline, and it wasn't intended to be unjust. It was set with good logic by the statistical gatekeepers of baseball at a time when there was no thought of admitting the Negro Leaguers. I would say that we shouldn't give the Negro Leaguers extra points or extra hits or nudge their statistics up or anything like that because they were excluded by systemic racism. I'm saying that we should count their numbers. And in order to count their numbers, there does need to be a baseline adjustment for minimum plate appearances and innings pitched. That's my counterargument in any case. I can see the validity of what you're saying. I don't happen to agree with it, but I'm not dismissing it lightly.
You mentioned before Gibson played 1 year in the Mexican League.
Two years, 1940 and 1941. And I make an argument in my book that those 2 years should be counted as Negro Leagues, just those 2 years. The Mexican Leagues have been counted as double-A baseball at various points in their existence. They've been counted as triple-A at various points in their existence. But for those, the Major Leagues had a lot of interchange between their alternate leagues, like the Players League and the Federal League and so forth. The Negro Leagues only had a lot of interchange between themselves and one league, and that was the Mexican League. And for those 2 years, driven strictly by bananas salary offers from Mexican League owners who were determined to make the Mexican League the top black league, Negro Leaguers, including Hall of Famers and All-Stars, flocked to Mexico by the score. In fact, even though they didn't represent an outright majority of players in 1941, Negro Leaguers had an outright majority of plate appearances in 1941 Mexican League play. And my argument there is that you look, for example, at the American Association. There's a high percentage of batters in the AA that never played in the National League. We still count them as Major Leaguers. There's a high percentage of batters in the Union Association, the Players League, that never played in the National League. We still count them as Major Leaguers. There's a high percentage of players in the Federal League that never played in the NL or the AL, but we count them as Major Leaguers. For those 2 seasons, the Mexican Leagues, by my analysis, contained more top quality black talent than either the Negro American League or the Negro National League. And if you look at the way that Negro Leagues have been recognized by Major League Baseball up to this point, there's a precedent, and that's the Negro Southern League of 1932. And I'm indebted to Kevin Johnson of Seamheads for pointing this out to me. We correspond quite regularly. The Negro Southern League was in minor league status in years other than 1932. It's admitted to major league status in 1932 because of the sheer number and quality of Negro Leaguers that participated in NFL baseball in that year. So my argument for the Mexican Leagues is the same. The Mexican Leagues, I think the only reason they didn't have an outright majority of Negro Leagues players, and I think they would have, is that their salary offers centered on the top Negro League stars. Those were the ones who flocked to the Mexican Leagues in 1940 and 41, the very top stars. I point out that no less than 18 participants in the 1939 Negro Leagues All-Star Game played in Mexico in 1940 and or 1941, for example. It was clearly seen as a third viable league destination for the top players. And by those lights, I think that recognition ought to be accorded. There's also a matter of fairness to Josh Gibson, and I'm actually in conversation with this. I've been selected to be a member of SABR's Special Negro Leagues and Teams Committee as a consequence of authoring this book. And right now we're discussing the potential eligibility of other leagues, other teams, particularly independent teams like the 1931 Homestead Grays, who were an independent squad, but who in years bracketing that before and after had league affiliation and who were packed with Hall of Famers and may have been as good or better than the 1927 Yankees. And right now they're not counted as a major league quality team. And they have, like Cyclone Williams, for example. Did Cyclone Williams lose his major league quality because the Homestead Grays dropped out of league affiliation for financial reasons and then suddenly regain it when they re-entered league affiliation? I don't think so. And I have submitted a paper to the SABR committee expanding on my arguments for the 1940 and 41 Mexican leagues to be made Negro leagues. The knock in Gibson's career is quite egregious. Interestingly, if you include his independent experience, which I think will be counted by this committee, that's just my personal opinion. I'm not speaking for them. If you include that independent experience, Gibson's actually more dominant vis-a-vis batting and slugging than he is if you also include his Mexican League play. The Mexican League play drags that down because the Mexican League was a tough league in those 2 years because they were packed with legitimate Negro League stars, as well as some very, very high quality Cuban and Mexican players. I think my chances of winning that argument about the Mexican leagues are less than my chances of winning the argument about independent leagues, which others share, but I'm going to take a shot at it. And I know that's a bit of a circuitous answer, but I do think that there's a strong argument for 1940 and 1941 Mexican leagues, just those 2 years, to be counted as major leagues.
Well, this is obviously a labor of passion for you. It is extremely well done and well
thank you.
Researched and well documented, and I highly recommend it. We've been talking with Philip Lee, author of Black Stats Matter, Integrating Negro League Numbers into Major League Baseball. Philip, good luck with your goals, and thank you for talking with us today.
Thank you, Ron. I really appreciate the opportunity.